Welcome to our fourth and final class on the Aguna Crisis, co-sponsored by Ohrid, the Organization for the Resolution of Agunot. The very first week, we saw how this crisis emerged. And there's really two contributing factors. First, we saw how Judaism developed the need for mutual consent in order to dissolve a marriage, which really emerged in order to help protect women in a time in history when women did not generally want to be divorced. Divorces were undesirable. The second kind of issue that exacerbates the Aguna crisis is the disempowerment of Batei Dinim. And we're going to kind of return to this topic very shortly, but as we mentioned in that very first week, it used to be that Batei Dinim had tremendous power. They could enforce their own rules, and people really didn't have any other choice but to go to them. It was, you know, even in a world which required mutual consent, Batei Dinim were able to decree that a person needed to give a get, and thus it was an easy solution. Unfortunately, nowadays that solution is unavailable because of the disempowerment of Batei Dinim. And we spoke about in the first week, kind of the disempowerment of Batei Dinim, on the one hand, you know, is in a kind of a wider secular society, can be a positive for many people, that we aren't living under religious law. But nonetheless, the fact that Batei Dinim have no power means that even when they have ruled that someone needs to give a get, it can't really be helpful. All that we can use is communal pressure, public pressure, which can work if the person is a member of the Orthodox community or the Jewish community, you know, writ large, and they attend kind of a shul, and the rabbi is sympathetic to the plight of Agunot. Fine, that can work. But otherwise, if the person is, say, an irreligious Jew with no interest living in the middle, you know, of New Mexico, you know, it's much easier for them to escape the enforcement of the Beit Din. And then we spent 2 weeks looking at the various solutions that have been proposed and kind of the controversy generated around them. And we looked in week two at the two New York get laws. The first of which was completely uncontroversial, but at the same time, not so powerful. The second New York get law was deeply controversial because it effectively allowed the state to consider the get in order to divide the assets, which raises the concern of a get me'usa, of a forced get. And a forced get is not valid, and therefore by an outside, you know, legal system ruling effectively on a halachic matter, that raised a controversy. And then in the third week, we looked at three other solutions that have been proposed. One is annulment, ways of just annulling the marriage. The second is invoking Kiddushei Taut, claiming that just as when one enters a marriage and they did not realize something about the husband, that their kind of their recalcitrance is justification enough to rule Kiddushei Taut, and to rule the marriage basically not null, but to kind of, you know, stop the marriage. And finally, we looked very briefly at the idea of zechiyah, that there is a principle that one can do things on behalf of another person halachically. And I mentioned Rabbi Dr. J. David Bleich, who's also a legal scholar, claims this is unique to Jewish law. But basically, you can do something that's clearly and obviously good for someone else on their behalf. And the, you know, it's instantly transferred to them. So for instance, you know, you can buy a necklace for someone, and it basically the necklace automatically becomes their own property because it's an unambiguous good. So the argument is we can use that same principle for a get, because fulfilling the will of the Beit Din is an ambiguous get, lots of other reasons. Again, that generated controversy. So we've kind of seen, you know, we looked at different solutions and why also people have opposed them in the intervening period of time. There's actually been two news stories which are very relevant to both what we've discussed and what we will be discussing today. And the first was a Beit Din convened in Israel, led by Rabbi Daniel Sperber, who's a rabbi in Israel, who invoked Kiddushei Taut in order to free an Aguna. So that kind of, you know, raised all the associated, you know, issues and invoked all the halakhic principles we'd been discussing. And the second, which is more relevant to the second half of today when we were speaking about in Israel, it was an Israeli bus driver who works for Eged. He was either fired or threatened with being fired if he wouldn't give his wife a get, because he was refusing to give his wife a get, which is also crime in Israel anyway. But the idea is basically, you know, there was pressure exerted on him in order to make it worth his while to give the get. Putting basically everything we've learned, dealing with solutions, we're moving into discussing two topics today, they're not solutions to the Aguna crisis. They're something very different. The first halachic prenup, the better language is a vaccination, because it does not help women who are currently agunot, if they never signed a halachic prenup, it can't do anything for them. However, anyone who has signed a halachic prenup cannot become an aguna. We'll talk a bit more about why, and I'll justify that claim. But basically, it's the vaccination. Just as you take a vaccine, you can't get sick. So too, you sign a halachic prenup, you can't become an aguna. The halachic prenup exists in order to prevent agunot from arising. And then the second half, we're going to discuss over the organization of the resolution of agunot, our co-sponsors. I previously worked for them, and we'll talk a bit about what they are doing and to try and solve the aguna crisis on almost a case-by-case basis, and also prevent agunot from you know, continuing to be created in our society. In a nutshell, when we talk about the halachic prenup, and you'll see there's very few sources, and then everything else is basically two of the four pages of the halachic prenup, which we'll get to shortly, but in a nutshell, the halachic prenup solves the problem that I recapped right at the beginning, and we spoke about in the very first shiur, the disempowerment of a Beit Din. So if you take a look at source number two, this was a source that was already familiar to us from the first shiur. The Pitchei Tshuva is quoting the Beit Meir, who's a major rabbinic figure, who says, "Lachein hamutav lefiyani nistaiti shelo lekafuto al haget." You shouldn't force the guy to give a get if you're a Beit Din. Ki im al achiyuv mizonot uparnasa or letashlumim hanidunya v'haketuva. But rather, there's various different payments we can basically enforce, we can extract him to give, that he basically owes the ketubah. The ketubah is, you know, the amount of money you owe your wife for support. In the case of divorce, you owe it still. The ketubah is basically an ancient prenup. Basically, the Beit Meir says this is a better way to kind of, you know, solve this situation where the husband's refused to give a wife a get. We just, you know, we give them the bill for how much they owe. And this person will, you know, they'll give a get, even if they'll unhappily give it. Nonetheless, they'll give a get because the alternative is this kind of, you know, not a financial penalty, which is a very important, you know, point to make if we're being precise in our language, because you cannot do a financial penalty, but the mere financial obligation. The ketubah demands of him will encourage him. You know, he has a choice to either, if he's still married, he owes his wife all this money, but if he gives a get, you know, that won't be enforced anymore. That's basically, you know, a traditional method of encouraging husbands refusing to give a get from having to give a get. This works, but it doesn't work nowadays. And there's a couple of reasons why it doesn't work nowadays. I mentioned before, try taking ketubah to a secular court. It turns out Aramaic documents, signed in Hebrew by two men who write their own Hebrew name and their father's Hebrew name, doesn't tend to hold much weight in a legal court. It just turns out, so it's not particularly, you know, powerful. Alternatively, even if you go to a Beit Din, again, they can't force you to abide by their law. They have no powers to, you know, throw you in jail if you ignore the rule of a Beit Din. That's not how it works. So all they can use again is communal pressure. So this method outlined in source number one seems like a really good solution to stopping husbands from refusing to give their wives a get, because it gets them right in the wallet where it hurts. But it's very hard to practically enforce this. And that's where the halachic prenup comes in. Because what the halachic prenup does, it does two things to solve the issue, you know, that are related to one another. First, it's a binding arbitration agreement. You see right at the top of kind of the prenup itself, it's a binding arbitration agreement. A binding arbitration agreement is you decide, and it's not a Jewish thing alone, binding arbitration agreements. It's recognized as a legal thing in a whole host of industries and in a whole host of reasons. You can sign a binding arbitration agreement, and that means you are legally allowing this court or this alternative arbitration panel to decide the, you know, legal aspects of the case. If a Beit Din rules on this matter after you've signed a binding arbitration agreement, the court will enforce it. So all of a sudden, we spoke about the disempowerment of the Beit Din. Well, once again, we've re-empowered the Beit Din. Because if you just go to Beit Din on your own free will and you don't sign a binding arbitration agreement, they can't do anything. But if you sign a binding arbitration agreement, you acknowledge the legal validity of the Beit Din's rulings, and the Beit Din can then take it to court. So if the Beit Din say, you owe $10,000, you can take, I mean, not you because you owe it, but the other person who you owe it to can take the binding arbitration decision to a court, and the court will be like, yep, you owe $10,000, you have to pay it. If you don't, you're not just being held in contempt of the Beit Din, but you're actually, you know, ignoring kind of a court order itself. So that's the first way that the beitin, the halachic prenup, sorry, solves the problem of the disempowerment of beitin, of it re-empowers the beitin. And second, all the halachic prenup really does, it rewrites the ketubah in legal language. All fundamentally the halachic prenup is if someone took the ketubah and was like, how do we turn this into an American 20th, 21st century legal document? It looks like this. And we'll talk a bit more about, you know, the features of this, but fundamentally that was its intent when being crafted. All it does is basically, you know, enforce the stipulations already outlined in the ketubah, already outlined in what the husband owes his wife in order to support her. Because again, if he's not giving her the get, the beit din can say, well, you owe the money. And he basically, with the binding arbitration agreement, he agrees in advance that he will owe this money to support his wife, which is otherwise being waived in kind of a normal situation. He will have to pay it. And so the halachic prenup solves the two major issues. And what makes it so effective is it solves the two major issues that, you know, cause so much otherwise problems in the going to batei dinim. It empowers them and it rewrites the ketubah in a language that's acceptable to the American legal system.
This has to be filled out at a beit din?
No. There's various different ways you can fill it out. It needs to be filled out in... It's an American legal document. So it needs to be... So the notary is interesting. Certain states require it to be notarized. Not all states do. The question that can be asked about the halachic prenup is, if you don't dot every I and cross every T, is it going to stand up in court as much? Thus far, all attempts to challenge it have failed. But nonetheless, there's basically, and I'll talk about this a bit more, but basically lawyers went through this with like the ultimate neuroses possible to try and find ways that it couldn't work. And you'll kind of see, actually, by the way, in the bottom left-hand corner, that it says revised November 2018. The one I signed was obviously different because I was married before 2018. It's constantly being updated in order to address halachic issues that are raised and also potential legal issues that are raised. So it's often tweaked. And it basically looks the same as it's always done, but there are subtle language changes and subtle format changes in order to, you know, make sure it stands up to, you know, scrutiny and doesn't have to, you know, we don't have to be worried about its validity. There's one extra, and this is more kind of a, you know, a fun fact. It's not even fun, but it's a fact. And the halachic prenup does go one stage further than the ketubah. If you look at source number two, this is the Shulchan Aruch Evan Hoezer. And he writes the following. Ha'isha she'yatza mi'beit ba'ala v'halcha levayit acher. A woman leaves her husband's home. She goes to another home. Im ba'a machmat ta'ana. She'hi b'shchuna she'yotza aleh ha'shem ra u'kiyotzi bazah. Chayav lozona sham im tava mezonat. If the reason she basically left is because there's some kind of bad rumor, unclear exactly the details, but basically she's left for kind of a valid reason. If she wants mezonot, if she wants support, chayev lozona, he is obligated to support her, to give her the mezonot. Aval im lo tiva machla al mezonot de la shava. If she doesn't actually claim support, fine, she doesn't have to go, which is kind of just a technical thing. The major force of Ashkenazi jury, v'akol hachi im haita la katata im ba'ala, v'lo mitada la ima, v'hamnia mimeno v'lavoto al mezonot. This is the case. Also, she had a fight with her husband. She no longer lives with him because he's preventing her from doing so. And she's borrowing money because she needs the support otherwise. Tzarech l'shalem. He has to pay it back. Aval im hamnia mimena. But if she's preventing herself from doing so, ein tzarech l'shalem. He does not have to pay it. De'ein ha'yishchayev b'mezonot ishto ela kisho ima. Because a husband doesn't actually have to provide for his wife if she's not living with him as wife. Now, if you think about the vast majority of aguna cases, the wife is left. He's perfectly happy for her to live with him, but she's left because she's being abused or she's missed, you know, for whatever reason. And so it runs into the risk here of this Rama that basically, well, no, if he's happy for her to live with him and she's refusing to live with him, she can't claim the mezonah, she can't claim the support. So the halachic prenup, and there's a lot of kind of halachic niceties of the prenup, which is not going to get into because it's a very, again, as with a lot of these things, once you scratch just one level below the surface, kind of the whole ground falls below you and it gets into incredibly technical halachic issues. But basically the ketubah's language, the prenup's language circumvents this as an issue by taking advantage of certain halachic principles that basically you can always in halacha commit yourself to do more than necessary financially. So the language in the prenup kind of prevents this from being an issue. It's just one example here of many, and we're not going to look at any of the other examples, but it's one example of many of a halachic issue potentially raised against the halachic prenup that is circumvented by the language of the ketubah, of the prenup. Yes, I'm going to keep on mixing them up the whole time. It's going to be one of those days. I remember once I was laning at a shiva house in our previous shul. I was like the last minute shiva house laner guy. So like I'd get a call at like 9:30 at night. We need you to lane tomorrow morning. And I remember one time, it was actually a friend's grandfather. So it was the one time like I knew like a lot of the people there. And I was like, I was tired. I'd not really had a chance for the laning. And I kept on saying Yaakov instead of Yitzchak. And everyone was getting really annoyed with me because that counts. You know, you're changing major points of the story here. And it's just like, and you're like, how am I doing this? Like, I'm literally looking at the name and I'm saying the wrong name. But, you know, it's, yeah. But thank you. Please always correct me. Because, you know, like sometimes you'll listen to someone and they make that obvious mistake and everyone's like, we know what he meant. It's fine. But like deep down, it grates on you the rest of the time. Because it's like, what if he meant it? So please, if I say the wrong word, please correct me. I mean halachic prenup when I mean halachic prenup. I mean ketubah when I mean ketubah. If I say the wrong thing, context should make it clear. But nonetheless, I do want to make sure I'm not saying the wrong thing. Before we actually look at a bit of the halachic prenup, kind of a bit of the histories in order. So fun fact. So the halachic, there were proto-halachic prenups for quite a long time. If you speak to kind of certain, you know, people, you know, who are a lot older than I, they signed some form of prenup. Rav Moshe Feinstein had some form of prenup. Rabbi Michael Broyd, who we've mentioned a few times before, had some form of prenup long before. But this halachic prenup was basically created by Rabbi Mordechai Willig. Rabbi Mordechai Willig is a Rosh Yeshiva of YU, an incredibly respected halachic figure. And he created this halachic prenup, and I'm gonna talk a bit more about kind of the history of it. The fun thing is, Rabbi Willig, you know, one of the classes you do in Smicha is what's called fourth year halachal maaser, or basically for 1 year they teach you a bunch of practical halacha stuff you need to know as a rabbi, where there's kind of a 5-week course on all related marriage stuff, and Rabbi Willig teaches it. So during that, he gives you basically a whole rundown of the halachic prenup and the justifications, yada yada yada. In my notes from that time, I didn't bother making any notes because, like, you don't need to convince me that halachic prenup's important. So in my notes, I literally wrote, should be done. Rav Willig has lots of stories and justifications for doing so, but, like, I only really made notes of things that's like, oh, good thing to remember. I wouldn't have thought of that stuff. I already knew. I didn't bother. So I had to then re-listen to the whole thing in order to get all the stories and get all the history. But basically, in Rav Willig is also, as well as Rosh Yeshiva, is also the rabbi of the Young Israel of Riverdale. In Riverdale, New York. And in 1989, there was a kind of an aguna problem in his own shul. And he says, you know, when he first became a shul rabbi, like 15 years prior, one of his big things was like, he's not gonna like have an aguna in his shul, like on his watch. And he's gonna do everything in his power to prevent kind of, you know, situations in divorce where the wife is left as an aguna. But divorce in his shul, it goes bad. He insists the husband give a get. The husband won't give a get. The other rabbis in Riverdale, for those of you familiar with Riverdale, you have the Riverdale Jewish Center, then headed by Rabbi Jonathan Rosenblatt. You have HIR, then headed by Rabbi Abby Weiss. All kind of the rabbis get together to kind of, this guy needs to give a get. He's banned from all the shuls. Fascinatingly, the judge actually in this case, and this is before the New York get law came into being, but nonetheless, the judge was still, I guess in New York, you're still aware of kind of, you know, Jewish divorce and stuff like that, because it kind of goes with the territory. So the judge basically said to the husband, and this, if you'll think back to the New York get law, you'll see why this kind of all gets around all those problems, which basically it's going to be 50-50 distribution. But if you give a get, it will be 55-45 in your favor. Obviously, the wife was also willing to do so, and so he gave the get basically for that financial reason. Unfortunately, one of the common ways kind of the aguna crisis is solved is by buying the person out, which is a terrible solution. Very often, the recalcitrance is in order to extract money. It's not something you ever want to do, but fundamentally, you always reach a point where it's like, you know, would you rather get a get or, you know, kind of fall on your own sword rather than giving the money? It obviously depends on financial situations. The judge, you know, kind of, you know, did this here, but whatever. Nonetheless, despite this kind of solution or despite this crisis being solved through the legal system, And Rav Willig, who was already teaching Masechet Gittin that year in YU, which obviously deals with divorces, he basically decided to devote quite a lot of his time to trying to figure out, like, how do we actually prevent agunot from occurring? In 1991, he travels to Israel to meet with Rabbi Zalman Nechemya Goldberg, who's a major rabbinic figure in Israel, who'd already at that point been writing various justifications to try and, you know, come up with ways to kind of solve the agunot crisis in a way that would appeal to everyone. He then kind of starts basically sending Rav Willig around to other rabbis to get support. They encourage like different languages. At this point, Rav Willig's kind of got like a proto draft of his prenup at this point. And he starts going around Israel, trying to get support from various rabbis, listening to their various issues, kind of apprehending, you know, issues they may have, get them on board in advance. Lawyers are also involved already at this stage, kind of going through the draft. Again, when you're in New York, it's pretty easy to find some, you know, lawyers who are knowledgeable of both sides of the issue. But, you know, basically you have Rav Willig slash other major rabbinic figures and lawyers combing through this document to try and make sure how do we avoid all the halachic issues it could possibly raise and all the legal issues it could possibly raise. He goes to Israel again, and he gets the support of Rav Avadya Yosef, the, you know, Sephardi chief rabbi, one of the most important halachic figures, not just of the 20th century, but probably of you know, the last few hundred years. Rav Willig says he has the original letter in his house. But, you know, and you can view kind of Rav Avadya Yosef's and a lot of the other rabbinic support letters as a website, which is probably also on the prenup at some point, but there's a website where they have all the, you know, letters of support. He goes to Rav Eliashiv also, who's another major Haredi figure, who had some issues with the halachic prenup. Rav Willig wanted to publish an article explaining why he still thought he was correct. Rav Eliashiv asked him to not do so, and Rav Willig has never published that article. But as you know, Rav Eliashiv has never come out against the halachic prenup. Because again, as one sometimes sees with rabbinic figures, even if they don't agree with something, they don't want to disagree with something either if it's going to result in a communal good. So basically, you know, if you think about kind of a lot of the issues we've spoken about in the past with kind of the previous other solutions, either they've had tremendous halachic approval but been very powerless in the case of the original New York Get Law, or alternatively they've been very powerful but have been greeted by the vast majority of the halachic community with either indifference or opposition. So Rav Willig, you know, very cleverly and very intently kind of, you know, killed both birds with one stone by making sure it would be powerful enough to work with the legal system and also making sure he got halachic support at the same time. In those letters of kind of support for the halachic prenup, some rabbis do raise the odd little issue with various things, but nonetheless, the halachic prenup is supported and is a halachically tight document. In the modern Orthodox world, it is therefore basically halachically uncontroversial, though we'll nuance that a bit. In the kind of outside the modern Orthodox world, less so. Though I remember reading, I think a year ago, that the Aguda, which is kind of, you know, the Haredi kind of equivalent of the Orthodox Union, for want of a better expression, is considering drafting their own halachic prenup, having seen the effect of kind of the Beit Din of America's halachic prenup. You know, it's been working really well, thank God. So now there's, you know, people are starting to think maybe we should come up with our own, because this is actually a good method for preventing agunot. It's not to say that there are no agunot in the modern Orthodox world, far from it, but there are, you know, dozens of stories of, because they used to call Ora to basically like tell them, you know, I would have been an aguna if it weren't for this halachic prenup, which, you know, forced the issue and now I got my get. Basically, the halachic prenup works in the following way. And if you now turn to it, so obviously we have kind of the signing stuff. So the first thing to just note is the arbitration in point number one, which is, you know, arbitration. Should a dispute arise between the parties so that they do not live together as husband and wife, they agree to submit to binding arbitration before the Beth Din of America, which shall have executive jurisdiction to decide all issues relating to a get, the ketubah and the tanoim, entered into by the husband-to-be and wife-to-be. Any issues and obligations arising from them or in connection with this agreement, and any disputes relating to the enforceability, formation, and validity of this agreement, and the arbitrariness of any disputes arising here under legalese is not my language. But basically, the fundamental thing here is the first thing you agree to, you will go to the Beit Din of America. They have full jurisdiction over, you know, get stuff. Section 2 is really interesting, and it's the most recent thing to have changed quite considerably. Basically, if you want, you can have the Beit Din do other things. Two, they can decide monetary disputes. You can also have them in 2B decide custody. This is, by the way, the one thing that technically the American legal system can always override. In England, you can never have custody done by another entity. A Beit Din, while England recognizes the validity of a gain binding arbitration, not in custody. In America, it does. You can have the Beit Din of America decide custody, but they can overrule it. Again, there is kind of legal language in here to protect the halachic prenup as an entire document while preserving kind of the court's ability to run in and change child custody. Other cool thing that we're not really going to dwell on, but basically if you were to kind of glance at the particulars here, the Beit Din of America, I mentioned before, has what's called a choice of law clause, where you can ask the Beit Din of America not to decide in accordance with, you know, straight up, straight down halacha, but instead to utilize, if you look at 2A, the parties agree that the Beit Din of America is authorized to decide all monetary disputes that may arise between them, and to utilize principles of equitable distribution in accordance with customary practice. You ask them to decide the case using basically the American legal system. There is a prohibition that we're not going to get into, but there's a prohibition of using the secular courts, and there is a question of, does that prevent Bate Dinim from using black and white explicit halachic laws to decide cases. So the Beit Din of America has their famous and controversial choice of law clause, where basically you can go to the Beit Din of America and within reason ask them to use other legal principles to adjudicate the dispute. So halacha does not work as of equitable distribution. So you can ask them to do equitable distribution instead. Alternatively, you can sign other ways to have them decide things differently. It's a fascinating issue. Again, it has been one of the major oppositions to the halachic prenup is the invoking of the choice of law clause. So the language here, which has once again been revised, prevents the issue of them really invoking secular law. It doesn't actually say anywhere you will follow, New York, code, blah, 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 blah. And again, the fact that all this stuff is optional is not only because you don't have to decide on it, that's legally and halachically important that this is optional. Because if you don't know what you're signing, you don't necessarily want to be signing it, but it's optional, so it's not crucial to the survival of the rest of the document, which is, another reason why this whole thing is optional halachically and legally. Section 2 is in somewhat of a gray area, or no pun intended. They put it in a gray area on the document because it preserves kind of the validity of the rest of it independent of this, which again is a very, clever legal and halachic way to do things.
That's the default. If you don't sign this now very broad agreement, I've looked at it.
Section 2?
Yes.
Then they don't deal with anything other than the get.
Okay.
Then you go to court for your distribution of assets.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the basic thing, yeah. The key part here is Section 3. Husband to be, and it should be noted, I printed the regular prenup. There are several other versions of the prenup that have been drafted to work in specific states. And there's also the reciprocal prenup, which prevents the flip side of the Aguna crisis, which is the wife refuses to accept the get. Generally, people should sign the reciprocal agreement, but kind of the default conventional one currently is this one. And so that's why the language is specifically directed to the husband. But in case you are wondering, there is a reciprocal prenup which works to both of them. But the support obligation, number 3, this is basically the crux of the halachic prenup. I obligate myself to support my wife-to-be according to the requirements of Jewish law governing Jewish husbands. That's the ketubah. Furthermore, I hereby now may achshav, that is to get round a halachic complaint we're not going to get into. Rav Aaron Lichtenstein was the most concerned for this idea of basically, it results in basically when can you actually enter agreements versus when you actually happen. So the halachic, Rav Lichtenstein thought you basically have to sign the halachic prenup at the wedding itself because that's the moment you're entering the marriage. So kind of the ma'achshav, this idea that you actually agree to it already now, that very clear language, circumvents that concern because you're already entering into agreement now. That's fine. Okay. In a manner that I cannot accept myself with any claim of asmachta. So again, we're not getting into that, but basically it preempts the complaint you might make, which is asmachta, which again, we're not getting into, but rest assured, asmachta is a, potential, game-breaking, you know, glitch of the halachic prenup, which you get around by, you know, it's been for a long time, this language has been in there, but it was not in there originally. This gets around that, basically. You can't claim the thing most people would tell you could claim to get around the prenup, because you're already signed, basically saying, the one major halachic objection to the prenup, I waive my right to claim that again. Or any other claim to support my wife to be from the date that our domestic residence together shall cease for whatever reason, at the rate of $150 per day. Parentheses. Calculated as of the date of our marriage, adjusted annually by the Consumer Price Index All Urban Consumers, as published by the Department of Labor. We'll come back to the $150 a day in a few moments. In lieu of my Jewish law obligation of support, and herein above cited and circumscribed, so long as the two of us remain married according to Jewish law, even if she has another source of income or earnings. Furthermore, I waive my halachic rights to my wife's earnings for the period that she is entitled to the above stipulated sum, and I recite that I shall be deemed to have repeated this waiver at the time of our wedding. I acknowledge that I have now, may achshav, effected the above obligation by means of a kinyan in an esteemed Beit Din as prescribed by Jewish law. So you mentioned before that you have to go in front of a Beit Din. So if you want to dot every I and cross every T, you know, but does it have to have been? Not necessary. However, this support obligation shall terminate if, despite husband-to-be's compliance with the terms of this agreement and the decision or recommendation of the Bethlen of America, wife-to-be refuses to appear upon due notice before the Bethlen of America, or in the event that wife-to-be fails to abide by the decision or recommendation of the Bethlen of America. Furthermore, wife-to-be waives her right to collect any portion of this support obligation attributable to the period preceding the date of her reasonable attempt to provide written notification to husband-to-be that she intends to collect the above sum. You've got to put it in writing. There's a story Rev Wittig tells, and I'm going to tell you that's why that's in there. Said written notification must include wife-to-be's notarized signature. The support obligation under Jewish law is independent of any civil or state law obligation for spousal support or any civil or state law imposed order for spousal support and shall be determined only by the Beth Din of America. Fundamentally, that's the crucial part of the halachic prenup. The main thing is it enforces the ketubah. The ketubah stipulates a certain amount. There's basically a chiyuv mezonah. You have to pay in order to support your wife. The ketubah stipulates $150 a day. It used to be $100 a day, but it was adjusted to $150 a day, and it gets adjusted by inflation still. Rav Moshe Sternbach is the main opponent of this aspect because he thinks $150 a day is excessive. So Rav Willig went to Rav Sternbach to try and discuss this with them. Rav Sternbach grew up in England, in London, and in the words of Rav Willig, speaks better English than me, but he insists on speaking in Yiddish. And Rav Willig showed him the data, because this is a complete side point. But Rav Willig is obsessed with data. And he has some very interesting halachic points of view that are generally fueled by data. And if you query them on him, he'll be like, prove to me, show me some other source that, you know, discredits this kind of, you know, point. So it's really fascinating because he does use data. He's as was once pointed out by a friend of mine, while some of his halachic positions look to us as closed-minded, he's actually one of the most open-minded people because he's always happy to see data that contradicts his view, and he will kind of change his halachic position fueled by data. His $150 a day is calculated by data. And it is an average, but basically how much money does someone need to live on in order to be completely supported without any other source of financial support? Rav Willig has the, you know, the Excel sheet, and he has the spreadsheet to argue that it's $150 a day. If you do the math very quickly, that adds up really quickly. I don't know if you've got your calculator out there or you're just texting because you're bored.
I'm pulling out my calculator right
one
now.
I forget how much it is, but it's... That makes sense. 150 times 365. Let's do the yearly amount.
$55,000.
That's basically how much a year you owe, adjusted for inflation. So you can already see, one potential flaw with the halachic prenup, which is if you are really, really wealthy and really dislike your wife, you can ride it out because $55,000 a year. But for most people, it turns out, 55 grand a year is a lot of money. And so $55,000 a year is a pretty, you know, hefty amount in order to be supporting someone on. That's the power of the halachic prenup. The other thing that kind of, the fascinating kind of second paragraph is all in order to basically the wife has to go to Beit Din, and she has to basically be, you know, intentionally using the halachic prenup in order to get her get, and not for another reason, because in 1992, Rav Willig tells the following story. So it was in Maryland, a woman takes her husband to a Beit Din for a get. The husband is willing to give the get, but she decides, let's do it until after the civil divorce is finalized. Civil divorces take a long time. After a lengthy civil divorce, she sends her husband for an invoice and for back support of around $100,000, based on the prenup, because he technically committed to giving, you know, $55,000. I mean, it was less back then, it was $100, but he basically committed to giving, you know, this amount of time, and it took, say, 3 years for the civil divorce. So she asked for $100,000, and there was originally no language in the prenup to prevent this from happening. Again, the prenup gets revised when it realizes there's a glitch. You know, just as with kind of computer software, they patch it, so too the prenup gets patched every time someone notices a glitch. It goes before the Beit Din of America to decide the issue. And they rule that the husband has to pay $10,000. Why $10,000? Because that was the original kind of time period between the original going to Beit Din. It worked out as $10,000. Fine. Rav Willig's line is everyone was unhappy because the wife, you know, wanted $100,000 and the husband wanted to pay zero. So they appealed. Usually you don't appeal in Beit Din, but the Beit Din of America has an appeal system, because the Beit Din of America, I will tell you, is the most fascinating organization to have ever existed, in that its sole purpose is to make Jews want to use a Beit Din. And so it basically is, you know, if you put a keeper on the Jewish legal system, that's the Beit Din of America. So they even have an appeal system, which no other Beit Din has. Like, that's not a thing in Jewish law, but nonetheless, they have an appeal system. So they both appealed. Rav Willig is the appellate judge. He's the dayan. He's also a dayan of the Beit Din of America. So he's the person who basically this case is turfed to, because no one else wants to take it on, because, you know, kind of a, you know, everyone's unhappy at this point. He decides the husband owes zero, because, you know, he had always undertaken everything in good faith. Yada, yada, yada. It was clear the wife was, you know, purely using the halachic prenup as a way to extract the money. The husband was always always willing to give the get. He was never against kind of compliance with the halachic prenup. She then took this to secular court, and the judge agreed with Rav Willig. You know, first of all, because you signed a binding arbitration agreement to agree with, and technically, if binding arbitration agreements are completely unreasonable, you can try and appeal in secular court, but if they are reasonable, then you can't. And, you know, if you signed a document that testifies, you know, so the Beit Din of the halachic prenup has been challenged in, you know, many, many situations, again, and is always, you know, it survives those challenges in court, because, again, it's a very well-written document. In Connecticut, and they tried to argue it somehow violated church and state, but that's been defeated. Unclear who, but someone has tried to argue it's coercion, to which the response is, like, it's not coercion when the wife is like, I won't marry you unless you sign this. That's not coercion. That's like any kind of partnership and negotiation. That's like, you know, I won't sell you this car unless you pay me $20,000. That's not coercion. That's normal transaction. Like, it's not, you know, it's not uncommon for the notion of kind of a conditional marriage. That's not coercion. You kind of, if you willingly agree to that, like, I'll only marry you if you'll live with me in New Jersey. Like, that's a valid stipulation to make in a marriage, and you will, you're not coerced into, you're never forced to marry anyone. Again, just to kind of recap, I mean, it's kind of, you know, it is what it is. It's a binding arbitration agreement, and it's basically turns the ketubah into a legal document while empowering the Beit Din at the same time. It survived all the legal challenges it's had, and the language is written and often rewritten in order to prevent halachic issues that emerge. And Rav Willig has kind of done something that has been, you know, one of the recurring themes of this series has been, you know, he has the capital to do this. Not every rabbi can, like, call up and be like, I want to meet with Rav Avadya Yosef. Oh, sure, but, like, you know, he's a Rosh Yeshiva of, you know, YU. He's the, you know, second in command of the Beit Din of the Beit Din of America. You know, he's a, you know, a well-respected halachic figure in the Jewish world. So it's perhaps easier than for most of us to kind of meet with the rabbinic kind of elite of the Jewish world, but he can do so, and he does so. And so he goes to try and get broad swath of support. It obviously has the support of almost all YU Rosh HaYeshiva. Fascinatingly, a few YU Rosh HaYeshiva don't agree with it, one of which on halachic grounds and two others for stranger grounds that I'm not quite certain of. But again, no one is claiming the halachic prenup. Everyone agrees with it halachically, and no one questions it, but the main opponents to it have often had their concerns either, taken away, or alternatively, it exists, or they are part of communities that don't have any interest in using the halachic prenup to begin with, or the Beth Din of America. But for the community that uses it, it is an uncontroversial document. And again, you can go online on the prenup.org, I think is the website, and they have a little here's our list of rabbis who support it, and it's literally a who's who of the rabbinic world. In kind of any shira, it's this rabbi says this, oh, he supports it, oh, he's, all the major halachic figures supported the RCA, the Rabbinical Council of America, adopted a resolution a few years ago that you cannot get married. If you are a rabbi of the RCA, you cannot be the officiating rabbi at a wedding that does not have the halachic prenup signed. And while the RCA is not in the habit of enforcing its resolutions, nonetheless, it has normalized the halachic prenup. And now it basically takes it from, I remember when I did a mock interview as kind of a practice round for rabbi jobs. And one of the questions I was asked, there was a panel of, rabbinic search committees from the New York area. And they asked me about the halachic prenup. And I was and I wasn't even working for Ora at that point. And I was just I had worked there as the graphic designer, but whatever. And I was I would never do a wedding without halachic prenup. That's just a rule. And at the time it was wow, that's a, they applauded my willingness to put myself out there. But even 4 years ago, it was that's a drawing a line in the sand. Now it's not, because you can then hide behind the RCA resolution of, you don't have to be I won't do this wedding. It's I cannot do this wedding. My hands are tied. The RCA forbids me from doing this without a halachic prenup. So basically the halachic prenup, has been normalized. Some still oppose it. Some still oppose it basically because they don't like prenups, because a prenup kind of presupposes divorce. And people, especially kind of more, what may I say, old school rabbis, don't like the idea of a prenup in general, because you're kind of entering a marriage with basically a document talking about your eventual divorce. One response is, hello, have you read the ketubah? But more than that, again, and this is kind of going to segue into the second part talking about Ura, but part of it is just about, again, normalizing it. It's about making this thing a done thing in our community. And so it's not, oh, we're thinking about divorce, but just, this is what we do. This is part of the various things we do in the run-up to the marriage. The second thing Rabbi Jeremy Stern, who's now the former head of Ora, the Organization for the Resolution of Agonot, one of his things he always pitches is he actually argues, a halachic prenup is an incredibly romantic statement, because you're basically saying, I never want to be in a situation where I'm going to want to hurt you. Even in a situation which would otherwise make kind of a husband and wife hate one another, I'm basically committing in advance that I don't want to be that guy. And so I'm signing the halachic prenup, which, again, that's just kind of a nice idea as opposed to an actual, strong stance. But nonetheless, the point of the halachic prenup and the point of kind of enforcing it is to normalize it, to make it the done thing. We'll pause for a couple of questions while we hand out these.
So is this part of the standard curriculum at YU now, in terms of...
Oh, teaching it? Well, as long as Rav Willig teaches how to do marriages, he's going to talk about the halachic prenup he wrote. And in general, and we're going to talk about... There's a second pamphlet here also. And in general, and we're going to talk about this in a second, I would say not just the New York kind of area, the New York, New Jersey area Jewish communities, but a lot of Jewish communities now, kind of the halachic prenup and general aguna crisis is something that's heavily educated about. Which brings us very nicely to talking about Ora, the Organization of the Resolution of Agunot, the kind of co-sponsors of this series. I previously worked for them as an assistant director of advocacy. I think that was my title. Basically, Ora has a fascinating history. A group of YU students were learning one year, I forget exactly what masechet, what tractate, but they were learning, I think it was Rabbi Tendler's share, Rabbi Moshe D. Tendler, who's also the son-in-law of Moshe Feinstein, and he brought up kind of as kind of a relevant application of what they were learning, the tragedy of the Aguna crisis. And one of them, the main guy, is a guy called Josh Ross, and he was like, is there anything we can do about it? And Rabbi Tendler was like, I guess. And basically they started kind of from a YU dorm, trying to, you know, advocate on behalf of Agunot, basically protesting those people who were refusing to give their wives gittin, trying to find out, you know, who is basically on the Beit Din's naughty list, who's not, you know, refusing to go to Beit Din. And basically that's how, you know, it started. Ever, you know, since then it has, you know, very much professionalized. It no longer runs out of a YU dorm. It has actual staff. It has actual offices. But basically Aura does three things, which if you look at the pamphlet, the Aura pamphlet, we're not actually going to read this like a source sheet, don't worry, but just because everyone's already opened it anyway, they do three things. Advocacy. Well, they do three things, slightly different three things. I was talking the other day to Aura, and I was like, can you just give me the rundown on the three things you do? These are the three things he told me they do. But these are the three things they do. Education, prevention, advocacy. Education is the main one. So they will go to shuls, and they will do school, and they will turn up at schools, and they do programming to make sure people are aware of the Aguna crisis so that they are sensitive to it, and also of the halachic prenup. That line that I mentioned before with Rabbi Jeremy Stern, because I was once with him in a school when he was, you know, doing the spiel about the halachic prenup, and that's kind of how he ends to a group of, you know, high schoolers. But, you know, so they do. There's a tremendous value on education. If you kind of like the Aura page on Facebook, you'll constantly see they're going to be at this shul speaking about this. They do post-nup parties, which is a separate thing we've not talked about because it's a slightly more interesting but complex thing. But you can also sign a halachic post-nup, which is, you know, does not have the raw power of the prenup, but is nonetheless still something. And so Aura does a lot of post-nup parties in order to, again, get more people to, you know, sign up to prevent kind of the Aguna crisis from continuing. So there's, you know, a tremendous amount of education, sensitivity, making people aware, normalizing, all those things kind of I was just speaking about before. Prevention, you know, it does, you know, a lot of stuff kind of related to that, I guess. It does a lot of stuff with the prenup, the postnup parties, prenups. You know, one of the best places to get your prenup signed is the Aura office. You know, great, fine, prevention. The main thing I want to focus on is this notion of advocacy. So the other thing Aura does to try and solve the Aguna crisis is to take people who are Agunot, women who are Agunot, again, there are sometimes men also, but we use the Aguna because that's the more frequently like 90% are women. Basically, Agunot on a case-by-case basis, it tries to figure out a way to help the woman receive her get. There are other organizations that try to do so, and they are kind of, you know, on the edge of the of legality. They often, unfortunately, take advantage of the women. They often charge a lot of money. They every so often appear on the news because they've been arrested. Aura does none of those things. It does not charge. It does everything. They even put it on the back. That's how you know this is a kind of the industry is not necessarily the best industry. So they make it known that Aura works strictly within the confines of halakha and civil law. Aura never does anything illegal. If you are in kind of an Aura case and you do something illegal, Aura will no longer help you. Aura doesn't, you know, so most of the industry of the get freeing industry is kind of guys with baseball bats or guys, you know, charging hundreds of thousands of dollars. Not good. Aura does it the other way, which is legal and, you know, it's still very effective. It's not as effective maybe as a baseball bat, but it's legal and it's much better that way. And that's how we want things to do. And the key thing is they don't charge. And for their services, you never have to pay Aura 1 cent. And I believe they even discourage former Agunot from donating to them because they don't want to create even that expectation that you owe them something. Yes, Mark?
Who sponsors Aura?
It is a charity. So you donate money to it. General recommendation, donate money to Aura. If the Aguna crisis is something that bothers you and you want to kind of, you know, put your money somewhere where you know it will be used to help an Aguna who's out there who doesn't have a divorce, you can donate your money to Aura. You know, most of its costs are employees. So, you know, there are definitely people who donate to Aura, like, I want to donate X amount of money to help. So if you get a get, you have to pay for a get. Usually it's 50-50. And getting costs, you know, you have to have a sofa who writes, you know, the thing. It's time intensive. Even though they can actually be written really quickly because, you know, you want to make sure you get it done quickly. But, you know, so Aura, you know, if, you know, a woman can't afford to pay, you know, Aura has kind of a fund to chip in for that. But basically, you know, it's still, that fund is big enough and gittin are cheap enough on that sense of, you know, grand scale of things that, you know, you don't need to donate to Aura. I want it specifically to be used for like this. You want to be like, I want them to get a new microwave in the employees, you know, area, because it turns out, you know, the more money it has, the more employees it can hire, the more it can pay employees and therefore attract people. You know, it's kind of classic. At the end of the day, it's a workplace. So just as, you know, Ruthie in, you know, the consultancy firm she works at, they're currently undergoing this whole process by like, how can we make your guys' lives happier? And it's basically, Ruthie is like old for the organization. So it's like, most of them are like, we just want free stuff. You know, so, you know, that's how you keep your employees happy. You give them free stuff. You know, they want to work longer. So to Aura, kind of, you know, if it can spend more on employees, you know, it makes them happier. It's a really depressing job. And this may, you know, come as no surprise. But it turns out this is not the kind of job you wake up in the morning, you know, being like, I'm going to talk to, you know, not very nice people for the rest of the day and try and help someone, which can sometimes feel like banging your head against the wall. So again, you donate money to Aura. There are obviously lots of organizations that provide support through grants, but you can send them a check and they will greatly appreciate it. Within advocacy, there's basically three different things Aura does. So again, just kind of this, the second pamphlet is one step forward. Rabbi Hefter, for those of you know who Jesse Hefter of Boston Erev, it's his son. He's basically the main guy, One Step Forward, which is kind of associated with Aura. This is just a divorce hotline in general. So if you have any kind of questions or concerns about divorce, One Step Forward is your first place to go to. But if you think you are an aguna, or in the course of your conversation, it sounds like you're in a situation of aguna, it gets turned to Aura. There's an intake process, obviously complex, not getting into all the details, but basically, you know, the case then becomes on the docket of a caseworker, and on a case-by-case basis, there's kind of three basically broad things you try to do. The first is navigating the beat-in. As you can imagine, for a lot of people, it's just confusing. They're not sure quite what to do. It can be a bit, you know, it can, even though the Bedding of America is a pretty, you know, transparent beat-in in terms of how it works, it can be intimidating. There are a lot of people in this world who find the idea of calling up kind of a, you know, a court of rabbis an intimidating process, and so they need help navigating it. Aura obviously does not just work with the Bedding of America. It will work with whatever Bedding, you know, you tell them you want to go through, and it will give recommendations on different batidin for different situations. Obviously, if you're a chassid in the middle of Brooklyn, the Bedding of America ain't really going to work for you, but there is kind of a, you know, some batidinim have better processes than others, or are more professional than others, or are more or less sympathetic to the aguna crisis as a whole. So there is a navigation of the batidin system to make sure you're going through, you know, a good batidin. And, you know, it's the little things like, again, Aura, you know, daily calls the Bedding of America to kind of, you know, chase up on certain things. And, you know, I remember, like, sometimes you'd be calling, like, one of the, you know, head people in the Bedding of America and be like, oh, wait, stay on the line. Someone else needs to talk to you now. You know, most people don't like calling up courts to nag them, but, like, Aura will do that for you. So just that navigating the batidin system is tremendously helpful and, you know, makes sure things stay on top of to-do lists where they need to on the Bedding of American side. The second thing it does is best described, though the word I'm going to use has a term in this arena of divorce, which is not what Aura does, but unofficial mediation. Not mediation in the actual divorce sense, but in speaking to both parties. You always call the guy refusing to give a get. You always are, hearing his side, validating him. It's very important to try and, you know, have both parties just reach an agreement whereby they realize that, you know, they can actually give the get. Sometimes the reason for the frustration could be something that turns out to be, you know, what we might not think is so significant, and, you know, you can help, you know, everyone kind of realize it together, you know, and everyone kind of walks away happily into the sunset. You know, finally, the third is the public pressure. This is what Aura is most famous for, but it happens on actually very few cases, which are the protests. They don't really necessarily happen in Boston because no one's driving up to Boston, but if you're in the New York, New Jersey area, you know, it's not uncommon for there to be a flyer being like, Aura will be protesting, and they get a group of people to protest, to stand outside people's houses, you know, or to stand outside people's places of work. Again, depending on your place of work, it can, you know, work for or against. You know, if you work for like the IRS, they don't really care, but if you're a professor on a college campus, you know, that turns heads if a bunch of people are, you know, protesting your spousal abuse. And, you know, that turns out to, you know, generate a crowd. So it does do public pressure. It only does public pressure if there is a siruv from the Beit Din against this person. That's the first and foremost thing we spoke about siruvim. That's basically an order of contempt from the Beit Din, which already halachically legitimizes, certain, communal actions to be taken. And furthermore, it only does things with kind of, basically a clear and unequivocal psak halachic decision. They mention, I think also on the back, the halachic posek of Ore is Rav Herschel Schechter. Who is, one of the, major halachic figures of YU. There's really a group of YU Rosh Yeshiva with Rav Schechter at the top. Think of Moshe in Parashat Yitra, where he's at the top of a pyramid that's then created. So too, if the halachic question is kind of a pretty simple run-of-the-mill one of the other YU Rosh Yeshiva, this is fine. But as, questions get more complicated or cases are more nuanced, eventually, it goes to the top of Rav Schechter. So there's a group of poskim, all of them reputable YU Rosh Yeshiva, who will work to once again give, halachic legitimacy to this protest. You can't just halachically decide to go protest someone without being certain that it's actually, within the, acceptable range of halacha. Basically, Ora works, on around 70 cases at a time, which if there's only two or three, case advocates, you can imagine that's a pretty, long to-do list. Thus far, 320 have been solved. 320 women have received their gittin. It averages out one every other week, which is actually incredibly impressive. And as you can imagine, some cases are easier to solve than others. Some it's, unfortunately, some cases Ora is dealing with where the woman's been an agonah since the 1970s. And obviously Ora isn't that old, but it's kind of picked up the case. But, sometimes you throw everything at the wall and something sticks. But basically, Ora has solved a tremendous number of cases. And in doing so, it's not seeking a broad solution. Ora does not offer, obviously, any halachic solution, even though a lot of the employees are rabbis. I mean, some are lawyers, some are, are trained in psychologists. But fundamentally, when I worked there and I had smicha, I wasn't doing rabbinic things in order to help. It wasn't like, well, I hereby declare this kedushe talat and now you are free. It's, only working within a realm of kind of, public pressure, Beit Din, navigating Beit Din, speaking with both parties, those kinds of things to try and figure out ways. And again, every single situation is different. Every strategy that has to be used is slightly different. But basically, Ora, helps resolve the cases this way. And it's starting to be a model for other organizations. There are like smaller organizations which are kind of taking the Ora model and setting up in, other towns in America in order to try and, solve the agonah crisis themselves. And also, Ora does become, in a weird way, like a one-stop shop for agonah crisis. So, not only do you deal with cases outside of America, like, I dealt with an Italian case, there are cases in England, and you're in conversation with, obviously, the Bat Yidanim in England. And likewise, Ora gets phone calls from other places, if you're the rabbi in South Africa, and all of a sudden you have an Aguna case, and it's rarer because your Jewish community is smaller. I mean, South African Jewish community is large, but you get my idea. You call Ora because you know they will have a good idea of, the direction to go in. So Ora really has done tremendous help in trying to resolve Aguna cases and continues to do so. Primarily, you can support it financially. But again, if you like Facebook, they have a Facebook page. They do events. All these various ways you'd support an organization. Again, if this is something I'm uncomfortable telling people where to explicitly direct their charity money to, but if you're looking for a place to donate charity money to, always a really good example of a place to give your money to. And it's not one of these places where all of the budget is going on executive travel. Sometimes happens with charities, your money is going towards, helping women get their gittin. And so that really kind of rounds out this series. We began with how kind of the issue arose, looked at various solutions that have been offered, and then moved today from the notion of a solution to, two other different types of approaches. The first is vaccination. Even if we can't find halachic mechanisms to, stop, to free agunot right now, fundamentally we can prevent more from happening, and thus the halachic prenup has done so and has been incredibly successful. And again, has fought, survived, strong legal challenges. in order to work as the vaccination on this, everyone should make sure they are vaccinated against the Aguna crisis. And second is Oru, which rather than trying to take a global solution, looks for a solution on a case-by-case basis by working with all parties and working with Bate Didim, and as a last resort, using communal pressure, that very same communal pressure we saw in the very first week, which is the last kind of resort of a Beit Din. But as I mentioned, the problem is often the Beit Din, you know, it's hard for people to really stand up and notice that the Beit Din is doing these things. So Aura kind of notices those things. It picks up those things. And now, even if you are an irreligious Jew living in New Mexico, if you are working for a company, Aura will make it known, because free speech is great, Aura will make it known that that company is employing a spousal, you know, someone who's perpetuating spousal abuse, and not all companies care, but some do. And, you know, all of a sudden, you know, this communal pressure, this realization that, you know, the Aura does not let people run away from this and leave kind of the wife hanging. It's kind of like Batman in The Dark Knight, you know, when he goes to Hong Kong and he finds the guy and then he brings him back to Gotham. Basically the same thing, without the drama and the music and probably the Oscar. But fundamentally, same idea is making sure that people who are refusing to give gittin don't get to just run away and cause people to suffer by using a case-by-case approach.